ARE Study Guide Podcast.
Hello, boys and girls. Welcome to another episode of the ARE Study Guide Podcast. Today we are going to look at the ARA document A201, General Conditions of the Contract for Construction. So the A201, the General Conditions, this is not a document that's signed. This document is just referenced by the other contract documents. So the same general conditions apply for the A101, which is the Owner-Contractor Agreement, and the B101, which is the Owner-Architect Agreement. Both of those documents, and probably others, reference the general conditions. This document is large, and I think it was about 30 pages. I recommend you read it yourself. We need to be familiar with these documents. If you want to find access to it, you can just search AIA document A201, general conditions, and if you put that into Google, the AIA website will pop up, and when you go on there, you just click sample, and it says it's a sample, but you can read the entire thing. It just means sample that you can't take the contract for free and use it. If you want to use it for your own practice, you pay for it, but just to read it is entirely free. And so, yeah, just go on the AIA website and click the link that says sample. So the first part of this document just contains the basic information, the project information, owner information, architect's information, and then it'll have a table of contents that covers the topics that are in the general conditions. And really neat, there's an index that provides specific topics so you can easily find where to look within the general conditions. With all the contract documents, they can be modified after they're signed. And the way that we modify contracts is through change orders, change directives, and any minor change in work that's issued by the architect. Typically, that's going to be in the form of an architect's supplemental instructions. And anytime we do that, again, change order, change directive, or a minor change by the architect, those documents are considered a modification to the contract. In this first section of the general conditions, it defines what the architect's instruments of service are. So the architect's instruments of service include the architect's drawings, the specifications, any sketches, models, surveys, or studies that the architect does. And we'll look into this later, but basically what the contract is going to tell us is that the architect owns the rights to their instruments of service. And unless this contract has been modified, the right for the owner to use it is non-exclusive, meaning the owner can only use the architect's instrument of services for that one project that they're building at the time. They can't take the drawings and then go build the same building somewhere else without the architect's permission. The architect owns their instruments of service. Section 2 of the general conditions talks about the owner and the owner's representative. So the owner's representative is someone that the owner assigns that has the legal authority to act on the owner's behalf. Also in this section, it talks about the owner's obligation to supply proof of their financial statements or financial capacity to fund the project if the contractor requests it, which totally makes sense, right? Before a contractor goes to build a project, he should be allowed to make sure that the owner has the capacity to pay him for the work. If the contractor requests this information from the owner has 2 weeks to provide it. And if they don't, the contractor doesn't have to start the project. Or if they've already started the project and for some reason something happens where the contractor thinks that the owner might be in some financial trouble and might not have the funding to finish the project, the contractor is allowed to request it. So say it's a big corporation and it's like making headlines that the corporation's going bankrupt. And there's a contractor building a big office tower for that corporation. That contractor is allowed to ask for evidence that they have the financial capacity to finish the project. And if they don't provide it in 14 days, the contractor is allowed to stop work. In this section of the contract, it also says that the owner will provide one copy of the contract documents, which would include the drawings and specs, to the contractor. And then if the contractor wants any more copies, which presumably they will want several, it's on them to make those copies. If the owner goes to the job site or the architect notifies the owner that there is non-conforming work means that the contractor built something that is not aligned with the contract documents. If the owner wants that work corrected, the contractor has 10 days from the day that they receive notice from the owner to correct that work. And if they don't, the owner is allowed to hire another contractor to fix the work and then bill the contractor for those charges. Section 3 of the general conditions talks about the contractor. Before the contractor signs the contract, they must visit the site to verify the site conditions. Once they sign the contract, part of them signing is them saying, "I saw the site," because the contractor is not allowed to sign this contract and then go to the site and then say, "Oh gosh, I didn't know it was like this. This is going to be $100,000 more." They can't do that. So as soon as they sign this contract, they're acknowledging that they've been to the site and that they agree that the scope that's in the contract and that the price that they've given the owner aligns with the site conditions. So the contractor is responsible for measurements and dimensions and site conditions. They are not responsible for double checking the architect's work. And likewise, the architect is responsible for their own work. They are not responsible for double checking the contractor's work. However, on both accounts, if either party notices anything, it is their responsibility to tell the other party. So in this section, we're talking about the contractor. The contractor doesn't need to double check the architect's work. However, if they notice anything wrong in the architect's drawings or specs or any of the architect's instruments of service, they need to notify the architect, and they will do that through an RFI. So if the contractor notices any errors or omissions in the architect's contract documents, they submit an RFI, a request for information, to the architect. An RFI, in general, it's just a clarification. It's a request for more information. It could just be asking the architect for clarity or help finding out where to find something else. It should not be a change to the scope. If the response that an architect provides changes the project's cost or the project schedule, the contractor needs to submit a claim because that is a contract change. The contractor is responsible for the means, methods, and sequencing of construction. That is not the architect's responsibility unless otherwise stated in the contract. And if the architect at all tries to tell the contractor how to do their means and methods or the sequencing of construction, the architect starts to become liable for those things, which they should not be liable for. Because in the contract, there's a clear separation of work there. Each party is responsible for the people that they hire and subcontract with. So for the contractor, they're going to have subcontractors that do different trades. They're going to have vendors and suppliers that they're all in contract with. And the contractor is responsible for each of those entities. The owner is not responsible for anyone that the contractor hires. The owner's communication is only to the contractor. They don't communicate with the contractor's subcontractors, suppliers, or vendors. Likewise, for the architect, is going to have their own consultants, the engineers, maybe the lighting consultant, who knows, all the consultants that an architect has. The owner or contractor cannot go talk to the architect's consultants. They need to talk to the architect because that's who the owner's in contract with. The contractor is responsible for everything required to build the project per the contract documents. the contractor cannot deviate from the contract documents without approval from the owner. And the only way they can do that is with a change order or construction change directive. The contractor is responsible for everything required to build the project, which includes the permitting fees, inspections, the labor, materials, equipment, water, utilities, and facilities. So all of those costs should be included in the contractor's bid. If they made a mistake and they didn't include any of those elements that they should have noticed that were in the contract documents, those costs fall on the contractor. The contractor is responsible for making a good quality building and using materials that are new. So the contractor can't go get some reclaimed wood or go to a abandoned building next door and just take the doors off and use them on your building unless the owner or architect specified that that's what they want. They are responsible for using new materials. So what if you have a building inspection and inspector says, this isn't to code? Who is responsible? Is it the architect's fault or the contractor? The contractor is responsible for building things to code. However, if the architect drew it wrong and the contractor just went off the architect's drawing, the architect becomes liable for correcting that to make it to code. However, if the architect didn't show anything in the drawing, but the contractor just built it in a way that wasn't to code, the contractor is responsible for the cost of correcting the work. And the architect's drawings and specs, they might say that they want certain things to be left open and visible for a visual inspection before they get closed off. This could maybe be like a plumbing wall or, let's say, electrical wiring or something. If the architect says that they want to see something before it's closed, the contractor is responsible for opening that up for a visual inspection. If the architect did not say that they needed to leave it open, but they have a feeling that what's behind the wall or in another enclosed space of some type, if they can't see it, but they have a feeling that something's wrong with whatever is in the concealed space, the architect can ask the contractor to open up that area. And if they find that the work is defective or non-conforming, it's the contractor's responsibility to fix that work. However, if they open it up and there's nothing wrong with it, the cost for opening and closing it back up is going to actually fall on the owner. Because in that capacity, the architect was serving on behalf of the owner. So the owner covers that cost. Just like the owner has the owner's representative, the contractor superintendent is kind of like a contractor's representative. They have the authority to represent the contractor and make decisions on the contractor's behalf. After the contractor is awarded the job, they provide the name and contact information for the superintendent that they want to use on the job. The owner and architect have 14 days to reject the decision if they don't agree with the choice of the superintendent. After that, the contractor is not allowed to change the superintendent on the job without the owner's approval. And the owner should approve it. They're not allowed to deny the request if it's a fair request. In this section, it also talks about at the job site, the contractor is responsible for making sure that all the drawings and all of the submittals, everything project related, is current. You can't have old drawing sets lying around and then you build things off of them. You need to make sure that all the drawings are current, and that is part of this contract agreement. Submittals are not considered part of the contract documents. Submittals are always to be reviewed by the contractor before the contractor sends them to the architect. This means that part of the contractor's review of the submittal includes verifying the measurements and quantities and potential construction issues before they send them to the architect, because when the architect reviews the submittals, they aren't going to be double checking any measurements or quantities. They are just making sure that the submittal aligns with the architect's design intent. If the submittal requires an architect's approval, the contractor is not allowed to build that work until the architect approves it. The contractor is responsible for keeping the job site clean and free of debris. Section 4 of the general conditions talks about us, the architects. During construction, the architect is considered a representative for the owner. The architect is responsible for making site visits. How often they make site visits will vary based on the project, but the contract says that they are responsible for making enough site visits so that they stay informed about the progress of the work. They are not responsible for inspecting the contractor's work or reviewing their means, methods, techniques, or sequencing, but they are responsible for verifying that the scope and the quality of the work is in line with the contract documents. The architect is responsible for informing the owner about the work's progress and promptly notifying the owner if they notice any mistakes, any deviations from the project scope, or if they notice that the project schedule is falling off. They are responsible for promptly notifying the owner. If the owner and contractor have a conversation that relates to the architect's scope, they are responsible for telling the architect what was said. They can't have conversations on the side that affect the architect. They are responsible for telling them about the conversation. Ideally, if they're going to have a meeting and it involves the architect, they will invite them to that meeting. However, if they don't, they are responsible for telling them about everything that was spoken about that relates to the architect's work. The architect is allowed to request that anything on the job be tested or inspected. If the architect makes a decision regarding aesthetics and it is in line with what the contract documents say that there's a section of wall that for some reason it's like at an angle and it doesn't show up on the elevations. And so they go to the job site and the contractor says, "What color do you want that wall?" And the architect picks a color that's already on the other elevations. That's in line with the design intent, and that decision is considered final. If the architect makes a decision related to aesthetics that are in line with the contract documents, the decision is considered final. Section 5 talks about the subcontractors. Again, with these documents, there is a clear line of communication. The owner talks to the contractor, and the owner talks to the architect. The owner should not talk to the subcontractors. Only the contractor should talk to the subcontractors. Only the architect should talk to the architect's consultants, because those are the entities that have the agreements. If the owner goes and talks to the consultants or the subcontractors, they have no contract. So anything they say is not legally binding, but it is affecting the work of the people that do have contracts, and that can get really sticky. So in real life, maybe those people talk, but by the book, they shouldn't. As soon as the contractor is awarded a job, they should provide the owner and architect with a list of the subcontractors they want to use. And just like with the superintendent, the owner and architect have 14 days to reject any subcontractor choice. However, those subcontractors that the contractor is providing that list, those are going to be the subcontractors that he got bids on when he developed his proposal for this project. So if they reject it, say the tile guy said, you know, $35,000, and then they say, "No, we don't want to use that tile guy," and the next lowest bid that the contractor wants to use is $50,000, well, the contractor is allowed to increase his bid price by $15,000 to cover that cost. He can't just lose money because they don't want to use the subcontractor that he picked. Section 6 of the general conditions talks about separate contractors. So the owner is allowed to hire more than one contractor, and they might do this to have different contractors work on different parts of the project so that it can be built faster. If the owner does that, they are responsible for the coordination of those two contractors, because the owner's holding those contracts with each contractor. Those contractors don't have an agreement, so the owner is going to be responsible for coordinating those parties. Section 7 of the general conditions talks about changes in work. Again, the contract can be modified through a change order, a change directive, or a minor change of work issued by the architect. Section 8 talks about time. Contract time is the date from the project beginning through substantial completion. The days are calendar days, not working days, unless otherwise stated in this contract. The contractor is not allowed to begin work until both their insurance and the owner's insurance begins. If the work is delayed for reasons outside of the contractor's control, such as the owner or the architect or bad weather, the contract time is extended to cover those delays. For that to happen, the contractor will need to issue a claim to request the extension of the contract time. Section 9 talks about payments and completion. So we talked about this in a different episode, but just two things to note here. Receiving payment does not mean that you're approving the work or that the work has been approved by the architect or owner. Also, the contractor has 7 days from the date that they receive the payment from the owner to pay their subcontractors. And the owner has the right to request evidence from the contractor that they paid their subcontractors. Because if they don't, those subcontractors or vendors could put a lien on the owner's property. So the owner has the right to request evidence that the contractor made those payments. Section 10 talks about protection of people in the property, and it states that the contractor is responsible for all safety issues. The architect might go to the job site and notice something that's unsafe that is not their responsibility to fix. They can notify the owner and or contractor of these issues, but it is not their responsibility. It is the contractor's responsibility for safety. Section 11 talks about insurance. The contractor is responsible for purchasing general liability insurance that covers the owner, architect, and the architect's consultants. Section 12, uncovering and correction of work. We already talked about this earlier. Just one more thing about this. If within 1 year of substantial completion, this is considered the contractor's warranty period, 1 year from substantial completion, if the owner notices that there's non-conforming work, the contractor is responsible for going to correct that work at the contractor's expense. Section 13 covers miscellaneous provisions, and this just says that the contractor is responsible for all the testing and inspections, but the contractor will tell the architect when and where the tests and inspections are in case the architect wants to be there. If a test or inspection comes up that wasn't known when the contract documents were made, the owner will cover those costs. The contractor is only responsible for the cost of the tests and inspections that they could have known about based on the contract documents. If there's some special inspections that weren't mentioned in the contract documents, the owner will cover those costs. If the test or inspection doesn't pass, but it would have had the contractor followed the contract documents, the contractor is responsible for covering the cost to fix the work. Section 14 talks about what happens when you terminate or suspend the contract. So there's a few ways this can happen. The owner is allowed to pause or terminate the contract at their own convenience. The contractor can only do it under certain circumstances. So if it's been 30 days that the work has stopped because the government shut down the project, or the architect refused to issue a certificate for payment, or the owner refused to share their financial information, or they shared the information and the contractor realized that the owner doesn't have enough money to fund the project, the contractor is allowed to terminate the work if it's been 30 days. If the work stops for 60 consecutive days, the contractor is allowed to terminate the work for any reason, if it's not, as long as it's not the contractor's fault. Or if there have been a total of 100 delayed days, which could be like scattered all over, not consecutive, 100 days of delays, the contractor is allowed to terminate the contract. If, again, all these delays, they can't be the contractor's fault. If it's no fault of the contractor, they're allowed to terminate the contract. To terminate the contract, though, they need to provide the owner and architect with a 7-day notice that they're going to terminate the contract. The owner may terminate the contract if the contractor isn't hiring workers that have the skills necessary to do the project. So if they're hiring people that are just like terrible and doing horrible work, the owner is allowed to terminate the contract. In that section, it says that the contractor repeatedly does this. So the owner can't terminate the contract if the contractor just hires one bad sub. It's if they continue to hire people that don't have adequate skill levels, then the owner is allowed to terminate the contract. If the contractor isn't paying the subcontractors or suppliers, the owner can terminate the contract. If the contractor is just disregarding laws and building codes, safety issues, if the contractor is breaching the contract documents, not building in accordance with the documents, for any of those reasons, the owner can terminate the contract. If the architect agrees with the owner that one of those things has happened, they will issue a 7-day notice to the contractor. The contractor will have 7 days to get their stuff off the job site, and after that, anything that the contractor leaves on the job site becomes property of the owner. And if the cost to finish the work is more than what the owner was already prepared to pay the contractor, like they go and hire another contractor and it ends up costing them more than it was supposed to, that cost difference will fall on the original contractor. The owner is also allowed to suspend, delay, or terminate the contract for their own convenience. However, any costs that the contractor incurs for starting and stopping the work, the owner is responsible for paying the contractor for those costs. The owner can't just expect the contractor to start and stop work at the owner's convenience. There's always costs associated with that. There's costs to move the equipment and people from one job to another while they're waiting for this owner. And the owner is responsible for those costs. So there's a few more things that the general conditions talks about, but we're going to dive into those when we talk about specific things such as non-conforming work, changes, means and methods, and stuff like that. So that's the general conditions. Definitely read this document. Become very familiar with it. These things, I think are really interesting. I can't believe I didn't know most of these things before I read this contract. And I think they're just wonderful to know for our practice. It took me a really long time. Well, not a really long time. It took me like 3 days to read this document because it was so boring. Maybe not boring, but yeah, sorry. Boring is not the right word. It's just a really tedious thing. You know, it's a really small font and the language is just dense and, you know, it's almost like when you haven't read like Shakespeare or something in a while, it always, at least for me, it takes me a little while to get back into the flow. So like contract language is a little heavy, but read it. If your test is in a few weeks, you know, maybe just chip away at it. I don't think you need to read it more than once. Just take notes on the notable things. Listen to this podcast episode again, unless you find it too boring and you think reading the contract's more engaging, then go for it. Read the contract a few times. But I think for the most part, everything you need to know, we're going to talk about. So review it. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, check out arestudyguidepodcast.com and go to the contact page and you can submit a message. Up next, we are going to look at the AIA document B101, the Architect Owner Agreement. See you on the other side.